It had been used recently, so it was not forgotten. The shooter had exited this way. Of that he was now certain. The base was a large place to search, and it had been abandoned for years. No witnesses to see anything. Everything was in disrepair, and only a chain-link fence overgrown with vines and bushes and trees around the perimeter. Easy to make one's escape completely unseen. As Decker shone his light around, he could see discarded beer cans and liquor bottles, empty condom packs and cigarette butts littering the floor. The place was a forensic nightmare. There were probably hundreds of DNA samples down there, most of them from bored teens looking for sex, booze, nicotine. His light hit on a discarded syringe and a rubber hose to pop blood vessels, or something stronger. But he doubted any of them knew that there was a passage connecting the base to the school. Even if they had explored the place, they would have encountered a locked door. If they had managed to get through that, they would run into a blank wall. End of exploring. And this would be a summer hangout place. Now that it was nearing winter, the unheated space was freezing. Their shooter would not have needed to worry about running into teenagers screwing and boozing here while he planned his massacre. He walked around the place and found nothing and no one. He pulled his phone and called the Watsons' house. George answered. Decker wondered if Beth was already gone for good.
"Hello? Who is this?"
Watson wasn't slurring his words. Maybe he'd slept it off.
"Mr. Watson, Detective Decker again."
"What do you want?"
he asked, clearly annoyed.
"Just a quick question. Had Debbie been spending a lot of time after hours at school, or maybe in the morning before classes started?"
"How the hell did you know that? How the hell did you know so much about my family?"
"Just a guess, but I am a detective. It's what I do. And your wife mentioned that she was home a lot more than Debbie. So I assumed she was doing something after school. So what exactly was she doing?"
"She belonged to some clubs. They had meetings. Sometimes they ran late. She wouldn't get home until well past dark. Why is that important?"
"It might be. Thanks."
Decker clicked off. He knew Debbie Watson was not going to club meetings. She was hooking up with Jesus in their private space. He next called Lancaster and told her what he'd found. He put his phone away, sat down in an oil drum, and waited with his eyes closed. He figured he would not have to wait long. He had left the door in the wall open. He heard the footsteps coming. One would have made him open his eyes. This was about a dozen. So he kept his eyes closed. A killer came alone, not with an army. He opened his eyes and saw Special Agent Bogart standing there.
"Another educated guess?" asked the man.
"Another educated guess," replied Decker. Behind Bogart was a group of FBI agents and members of the Burlington Police Department. Lancaster stepped forward.
"I called Mac. He's on his way,"
she reported, and Decker nodded slowly.
"How did you figure this?" Bogart asked Decker.
Decker gave him the 2-minute drill on his deductions.
"If you had briefed us on your meeting with Beth Watson, we might have been able to help you on this," Bogart pointed out. "We might have gotten here sooner."
"We might have," agreed Decker. Bogart ordered a search of the place and the perimeter, and then pulled up an old wooden bench and sat down next to Decker while Lancaster hovered nearby.
"So the shooter befriended Debbie Watson, found out about this link with the school, and used it to get away?" said Bogart.
"He used it to both get in and get away. With the passage, he could come and go as he pleased. He seduced her. He's a grown man. She's an impressionable teenager with not the best of home lives. They must have had a bunch of trysts here that no one else knew about. She must have felt really special, right up until he discharged a shotgun in her face.
We'll contact the army and get all we can on the base."
"Yeah, good luck with that."
"I'm surprised no one knew about this passage," said Bogart, "other than the Watsons."
"Well, If it was originally built in 1946 or close to it, most of those folks would be dead. I doubt they would have told the kids about it, so only the school officials would have known. Maybe it was never used. Maybe they never even had a practice drill. I don't know. Even if they did, the students from back then would be fairly elderly now. Maybe they forgot about it.
But you said Simon Watson added to the passageway?
He came to McDonald in the late 60s, and sometime after that, the passage from the base was put in. But when the base was closed, everybody left. Lots of people who worked here in uniform were probably transferred to other places.
Lancaster interjected.
And even if there were folks left here who knew about the passage, I doubt they'd think about a killer using it to move around the school. They'd assume it was sealed up after all this time. The public probably believes he shot up the place and made a run for it and got away.
Bogart nodded. But he could have gotten into the school more easily from this way, meaning the army base end. But he apparently was in the cafeteria and traversed the school that way. Why?
I don't know, said Decker.
We thought it might be to allow him to cut through the wall ceiling off the door behind the sign in the cafeteria. But now since I believe he's been in and out of here a lot, he could have done that any time. And he probably wouldn't have waited until the night before the planned attack, in case something went wrong. He paused. So bottom line, I don't know.
I thought you had all the answers.
Then you thought wrong. Bogart considered him thoughtfully.
You really don't forget anything, do you?
Decker didn't look at him. Bogart drew closer and said in a low voice that only Decker could hear,
What makes you tick, Decker?
What do you have up in your head that allows you to do what you do?
Decker didn't acknowledge that he had heard the comment.
You always tune out like this? When someone is trying to have a conversation?
Bogart asked. My social skills aren't the best, said Decker. I told you that already.
But you can walk and chew gum at the same time, so if you have some special mental ability, it hasn't affected your capacity to function out in the world.
Now Decker looked at him.
Why do you say that?
Bogart said,
My older brother has a form of autism, brilliant in his field, positively clueless in interacting with another human being. He can't carry on a conversation beyond a few mumbled words, and he's actually considered high-functioning because he can work at a job.
What's his field?
Physics, subatomic particles more specifically. He can expound all day about quarks, leptons, and gauge bosons. But he forgets to eat and has no idea how to book a plane ticket or pay the electric bill.
Decker nodded. I get that.
You seem to do okay, though.
It's all degrees, Special Agent Bogart.
You've been this way since birth?
Later, Decker said tersely.
Which might be why I can walk and chew gum at the same time, he added in a tight voice before looking away. Bogart nodded.
You don't want to talk about this, do you?
Would you?
Bogart rubbed his hands along his thighs.
We need to get this guy, and we have one thing that we haven't really broached yet.
Decker looked at him.
His thing with me.
Bogart nodded.
He sent you two messages. One coded, one not. That was a risk for him. He had to go back to the house where he committed the murders of your family to write one of the messages. Someone could have seen him. And he went to Debbie's house, again, with the risk of being seen. Now, anyone who kills is a risk-taker by definition. But like you said, it's a matter of degrees. A killer like this may not want to get caught, so he will minimize his risk. But that was outweighed by his desire to communicate with you. That's important. Because it makes me believe that he feels he has a connection with you somehow that is very strong, very deep.
Decker fixed his gaze on the other man.
You were at Quantico?
BAU?
Behavioral Analysis Unit. Yes. I was what the movie and TV folks would call a profiler. And I was pretty good at it.
There are no profilers in the FBI.
You're right. Technically, we are referred to as analysts, and sometimes we're right and sometimes we're wrong. Some say psychological profiling lacks empirical validation, and they may be right, but I don't really care. All I care about is catching the bad guys before they can hurt someone else, and I'll use whatever tools I have at my disposal to do so. He peered more closely at Decker. And I'm considering you to be one of those tools.
Meaning what exactly?
Meaning that I'd like you to work more closely with us. Together, we may be able to make headway.
Decker looked over at Lancaster, who had clearly heard this last exchange.
Decker rose. I've already got a partner. If we break anything, we'll let you know.
He walked off. Lancaster waited for a moment, flicked Bogart a tight smile, and scurried after Decker.
Special Agent Bogart remained sitting, staring after them both.
This audiobook has been broken into multiple parts to make the download faster. You have reached the end of a part, but not the end of the complete audiobook. So please check your library for the next part of this audiobook.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.
This is Audible.
Hachette Audio presents Memory Man. Written by David Baldacci. Read by Ron McLarty and Orla Cassidy.
Chapter 30.
Decker opened his eyes. He was lying in bed, but sleep was elusive. It was raining outside his room at the Residence Inn. This time of year, as fall hunkered down before giving way fully to winter, was always loaded with rain, usually with strong winds that beat the moisture right into your brain. A size 9 shoe. They had confirmed the size. On a guy 6'2", 200 or more pounds, with shoulders as wide as his? He closed his eyes, and his mind whirred back to the image on the camera. But it only showed the man from the waist up. Decker now was sure that it was intentional. Waist up. He had also walked in front of the camera in a way that was designed to hide how he had actually come into the school. Not from the rear doors, but from the cafeteria via an underground passage. Yet Decker had seen something that didn't make sense. He just wasn't sure what or where. He never forgot anything. But that didn't mean everything was always placed in the proper context opposite either a complementary or conflicting fact. He was just starting to do that when he heard the noise outside his door. The Residence Inn was set up so that each room opened directly to the outdoors. Decker was on the second story. A catwalk with a wrought iron railing formed the exterior of this floor, with stairs down at each end to the parking lot. The noise came again. A scraping, it seemed, against the wall outside his door. The rooms on either side of his were empty. The first floor of the inn was mostly full. He sat up in bed and looked at the door. He reached out and his fingers closed around his gun, which he kept on the nightstand. He chambered around, moving the slide slowly so the sound of it moving back and forth was diminished. He threw off the covers, pulled on his pants, slipped his phone into his pocket, and skittered over to the door in his bare feet. He stood to the right of the door, his gun held down with both hands. He listened. There it was again. The scrape. Something was out there. Maybe someone was out there. He would do this as he had many busts as a cop, except in reverse, going out the door instead of in. He slipped off the security chain, stood to the side, gripped the knob, counted to 3 in his head, and threw the door open. He catapulted through the opening, swinging his gun first left, then right. He stopped and stared up at her.
She had been hung on the bracket supporting the exterior light, her feet hitting against the side of the wall were the source of the scraping he'd heard. He checked her pulse at the carotid, but did so only mechanically. She was dead, her eyes open, glassed over, and fixed in a way the living could never achieve. FBI Special Agent Lafferty had written down her last note. He looked over her body, but could find no obvious signs of how she had died. Then he turned and ran down the catwalk, reached the stairs, and hurtled down them. She couldn't have been up there long. Whoever had done it might still be around. He pulled his phone and dialed 911. He told the dispatcher everything she needed to know in 3 succinct sentences. Then he called Lancaster. She answered on the 4th ring. It was 3 in the morning. She had no doubt been asleep. After his first sentence, she was wide awake. After his second, he could hear her fumbling for her clothes. He put his phone away and sprinted around the parking lot in front of the Residence Inn. He was looking and listening. Any vehicles starting up? Any feet running away? He heard neither. Only his own tortured breath. He stopped and bent over, trying to refill his lungs. He felt himself shaking, his stomach churning. When he looked up, he saw them. The army of 3s was charging him, knives raised, ready to kill. He knew they were not real, but this night the terror seized him, like it had the first time he had seen them. He bent farther over and threw up on the asphalt, the 6 splashing onto his bare and now frozen feet. When he straightened, he heard the first siren, and the army of 3s seemed to dissolve with the sound. A minute later, the first siren was joined by another. He walked unsteadily back up the steps to his room. He leaned against the catwalk railing, facing Lafferty's body. He wanted to close her eyes, lift her off the bracket, and set her gently down on the concrete with her hands folded across her stomach. Peaceful, as if he could ever make violent death so. He certainly couldn't do it for his family. But he could do none of those things without corrupting the crime scene. So he just stood there. When the patrol cars lurched to a stop in the parking lot, he slipped into his room and put his gun back in the nightstand. By the time he got back outside, the officers had sprinted up the steps and come to a stop a few feet away. Decker held up his lanyard. He didn't recognize either patrolman and didn't want them to think the wrong thing. Amos Decker, I'm the one who called it in. Detective Lancaster is on her way. The cops had their guns drawn and were scrutinizing him closely. One drew near to him and checked out his lanyard. He said to his buddy, I saw him at the school with the detectives yesterday. It's okay. The cops holstered their weapons and stared up at the dead Lafferty. She's FBI Special Agent Lafferty, said Decker. You might have seen her at the school, too. Both cops shook their heads, but the first one said, Shit, a Fed? How'd she die? I don't know. Nothing obvious that you can see. Okay. Decker stepped back from the body. Not telling you anything you don't know, but I was a cop for 20 years. You should go ahead and secure the crime scene and call in the forensics team and the ME. I'm sure Detective Lancaster will also alert the proper people, but it's a Fed, like you said, and you need to follow the book tight on this one. The first cop said, Good advice. I'll phone it in. The other cop said, I'll get the perimeter tape. Decker pointed to the open door. This is my room. I heard a noise and came outside to check. That's when I saw her. I went down to the parking lot, but I saw no one. Didn't hear a vehicle either, or anyone running away. And the puke down in the parking lot belongs to me. I'm not used to running that fast or far anymore. Okay, Mr. Decker. I'd like you to go inside your room. I'm sure Detective Lancaster will see you when she gets here. He stared up at the body and suddenly looked uncertain. We're sure she's dead? No pulse. I checked. And she's already cold. Been dead a while. Decker went inside his room, closed the door, went to the bathroom, washed his face and his feet, put on his shoes, sat on his bed, and waited. He knew where Lancaster lived. He figured 30 minutes or so tops. 10 minutes later, he heard activity start up outside his door.
18 minutes after that, there was a knock on his door. He opened it, and there she was. He looked past her. The body was on the concrete on top of a sheet, designed to collect any and all trace evidence.
A tech team was swarming the small area, taking pictures and measurements and looking for evidence in all the obvious places. The ME, a small bearded man in his 60s, was kneeling next to Lafferty. After doing his TOD test, he looked up at Lancaster. "She's been dead about 3 hours," Decker said. "Puts her death at about 12:30.
"Cause of death?"
asked Lancaster. The ME lifted up her blouse. Underneath was a single stab wound.
"Up and in," he said, "right to the heart. Dead almost immediately. She obviously bled out somewhere else, but there wouldn't have been much external bleeding. The knife pierced the heart. It would have stopped pumping."
Something occurred to Decker. He said, "Did you check her genital area? Anything there?" Lancaster gave him a sharp glance and then looked at the ME. The look on the ME's face gave Decker the answer. He showed them the spot. The killer used a very rough knife to do the mutilation. Lancaster looked at Decker.
"Like before, with..."
Decker said, "Yeah, like before." Three black SUVs pulled into the parking lot.
"Here come the feds,"
said Lancaster nervously.
"I called them on the way over."
Bogart headed the pack, taking the steps two at a time. His hair was disheveled, and he was dressed in jeans and a pullover, with canvas boaters on his feet and no socks. The men behind him were similarly dressed, but wore their blue FBI windbreakers. Bogart walked directly over to the body and looked down. Then he rubbed his eyes, then his chin, and looked away, over the railing, at the darkness beyond. Decker heard him mutter, "Shit." Then the FBI agent turned to them. "What do we know so far?" Lancaster told him the time and cause of death, and also about the mutilation the ME had discovered.
"You see or hear anything?"
asked an ashen-faced Bogart, as he looked at Decker. Decker told him what he knew. He added, "I was half asleep. The scraping noise could have been going on for a while before I heard it." Lancaster said,
"Do you know her movements this evening?"
Bogart didn't seem to hear her. Decker added, "If we can pinpoint her movements, we might be able to get a lead on whoever did this."
"I know that," snapped Bogart.
Lancaster said,
"We know this is extremely difficult, Agent Bogart."
Decker cut her off. "But you know better than most that the sooner we get a lead, the better our chances are. And the reverse is also true." Bogart glanced once more at Lafferty and motioned them to the stairs. They climbed into one of the black SUVs, Bogart in front and Lancaster and Decker in the back. Bogart drank down a small bottle of water that was sitting in the front console, wiped his mouth with his hand, and turned to look at them.
"Lafferty was a good agent. A protege of mine, in fact, not just a note-taker,"
he added with a sharp glance at Decker, who said nothing in reply. Bogart sat back, let out a long breath, and said,
"I've never lost an agent. It's difficult to process."
"I'm sure,"
said Lancaster.
"But her whereabouts," said Decker.
"Were you all staying at the same place?"
"Yes, the Century Hotel."
"Were you all on the same floor?"
"No, we were spread over three separate floors, but Lafferty was next door to another agent."
"When was the last time anyone saw her?"
asked Lancaster.
"I asked everyone that on the way over. It looks like 9:30. She was working in Agent Darrow's room going over some files.
She said good night and went back to her room."
"But do we know that she actually went to her room?" asked Decker.
"As a matter of fact, she mentioned to Darrow that she was running out for some things she needed."
"Did she say what and where?"
"From what she said, he thought it might be stuff at a pharmacy. I don't think it was the first time she'd done it. We were called out on this pretty fast. Agents don't have a lot of time to prepare."
So she'd gone to get things before?
Said Lancaster.
Maybe from the same place?
Right. Just travel stuff, probably, said Bogart, staring out the window, his mind evidently a long way away. Decker sat back, closed his eyes, and thought for a moment. There's an all-night pharmacy 2 blocks over from the Century. That's where I would go to pick up stuff I'd need while traveling. And it has video cameras in the parking lot. Well, let's go see if it shows anything, said Bogart. The drive only took about 20 minutes at that time of the morning, and with Bogart exceeding all posted speed limits. It was not yet 4 a.m., and thus Burlington was still very much asleep. Traffic was scant, pedestrians non-existent. There were 2 people in the open all-night pharmacy. One was behind bulletproof glass with the cash register, the other was stocking deodorant on the shelf. Both had been on duty since 8 p.m. Bogart showed the photograph of Lafferty and asked if either employee had seen her.
I haven't seen her tonight, but she came in the night before.
Decker said, which means she might not have made it here. They asked for and were given the DVD from the surveillance cameras for the parking lot. She would have walked here, said Decker. It's too close to drive. And none of our vehicles are missing, said Bogart. They loaded the DVD into a laptop Bogart had in the SUV. There was a timestamp on the feed, and Bogart fast-forwarded to right before 9:30. The frames ran as they all huddled around the screen watching intently. When they got to 9:58, Decker saw it. That's her. Lafferty had emerged from an alley next to the pharmacy. She had taken 2 steps when she was abruptly pulled back into the alley. Run it again and slow it down, said Decker. Bogart did so, playing through the scene 5 more times and enlarging the images as much as he could on the small screen. Decker stared at the screen intently, every pixel being memorized and placed in his head. Can't see who it is. We can try to enlarge the shots, said Bogart. My guys can work wonders. He knew the camera was there, said Decker. Just like at the school, he didn't want to be seen, at least certain parts of him. How did he overpower her so quickly? Said Bogart. Lafferty was no weakling. Decker said, there was a gloved hand at her throat. There might have been something in it. She seemed to go stiff pretty quickly. I think he injected her with a paralytic.
Blood test on her body will confirm that,
said Lancaster. So, 9:58 she was taken, said Decker.
But her TOD was around midnight.
Which means they had her for 2 hours before they killed her, completed Decker. Bogart looked strained. You said she was mutilated. Do you think they did anything else to her? Decker shook his head. My wife was not raped, but she was mutilated. In that same area, he added. So what is this about? Asked Bogart. Why do that? It makes no sense. When I asked Leopold if he'd done anything else to my wife, he didn't answer. Now, the mutilation was never made public. He could only know about it if he was there, which we know he wasn't. But someone who was there could have told him about it. But since he didn't answer, I don't know if he didn't know or just didn't want to tell me. Either way, he's still a suspect. Bogart rubbed his face. What else? They had her for 2 hours. Probably some of that time she was conscious before they killed her.
What would they do to her?
Asked Lancaster.
Try to find out in which direction the investigation is going, said Bogart.
Decker nodded at this. They would want to know what we know, if we'd gotten to certain points or not.
Well, Lafferty would tell them nothing, Bogart said sharply.
No one is invulnerable to interrogation, depending on the tactics they use, said Decker. She may have talked against her will. Regardless, to be safe, we should assume they now know what we know. Principally that we found the underground passage. Bogart looked at the frozen screen, at the hand around his colleague's neck. But how could she not know the guy was following her? He said. He must have been right behind her. Lancaster said,
"He could have been hiding in the alley."
Bogart shook his head. What? Waiting for her to come along? How would he even know she was going to the pharmacy? He could have been waiting and watching and following her when she came out. She'd been to the pharmacy before at least once. Maybe they knew this somehow, and saw an opportunity if she went there again. And she could have known he was there, but for some reason didn't feel threatened, added Decker. Not feel threatened, exclaimed Bogart. A dark alley? A murderer running around? How would she not be on her guard? She might not feel threatened if it was someone she had no reason to suspect, elaborated Decker. Bogart's face turned crimson and his features ugly. Are you accusing me or one of my men of her murder? He snapped. Because she doesn't know anyone else in this shithole. Now my point, really, said Decker calmly. Bogart pointed a finger in Decker's face. She was left at your doorstep. Maybe you killed her, you son of a bitch. Decker's face remained impassive and his words slow and deliberate. And left her on my doorstep to incriminate myself? And then call the cops while I just sat there? If I really did something that stupid, I could beat the rap on an insanity plea. Bogart looked like he wanted to punch Decker, but then he mastered his emotions and looked away. Lancaster said,
Amos, do you mean someone in uniform? A cop? She wouldn't suspect someone like that.
Yes, said Decker. That's exactly what I meant. Bogart glanced at him sharply and nodded. Right. Sorry I jumped down your throat. He paused and then declared, Okay, we're going to tear that damn alley apart. He got on the phone and called in his team. Then he turned to Decker. We need to work on this together. We have got to stop this guy. Decker shook his head. Not guy. Guys.
What makes you say that?
Asked the startled Lancaster as Bogart stared at him.
The shooter appears to be a loner. You said that.
And I was wrong, Decker said decisively. But what specifically makes you think there could be more than one man involved? Asked Bogart. Because no one can be in two places at the same time. Chapter 31 Sunrise. The clouds had gone and with them the rain. So it was true sunrise, where the colors changed at first subtly and then subtly transformed the heavens in a way that no other occurrence could, short of a nuclear bomb and its towering mushroom cloud. Yet both were transformative in their own right. One side of the world was lit, the other enveloped in blackness. The bomb's kiss was for real. The sun's movement was a metaphor for either darkness descending or light arising. Decker stood there on the pavement and watched this all take place. Despite the coming light, his mood remained trapped in the deepest darkness. He had not gone back to sleep after leaving Bogart and Lancaster. There would have been no point. The 7-Eleven faced him across the width of the asphalt. It was open. It was always open. Through the glass, he could see the same woman counting packs of smokes. But a different punk was mopping the floors. Perhaps Billy had moved on to another bucket in another town, or maybe he was recovering from a night out with the ladies. He didn't know why he had come here after leaving Lancaster and Bogart, but this place kept drawing him back like metal to a magnet. He stepped through the door, and when the little bell tinkled, it felt like a drill bit boring right through his skull.
Are you all right?
Decker refocused and found the woman's gaze on him. She looked a bit frightened, and when he caught his reflection in the mirrored door of a chiller cabinet containing soda, he could understand why. He looked wild and demented, and his clothes were dirty, and his hair disheveled.
You were in here the other day, looking for someone.
Decker nodded and looked around. Where's Billy? The floor mopper.
Today he comes to work in the afternoon. Did you find the man you were looking for?
Decker shook his head. But I'll keep looking.
You look like you could use some coffee. It's fresh. I just made it. In the back there. Only $1 for a large. It's a good deal. Maybe some food?
The doorbell tinkled again and two men in dungarees, work boots, and flannel shirts stomped in. One went to the counter for some cigarettes. The other went to the soda fountain and proceeded to fill a giant cup with Coke. While the woman attended a new customer, Decker drifted to the back of the store, got his coffee, hooked a packaged pastry from a shelf, and went up to the counter. He waited behind the guy ordering smokes, who also wanted lottery tickets with particular numbers. As Decker waited, his gaze flicked absently to the newspaper stand next to the counter. The paper lay flat on it, the upper fold of the front page fully exposed. He nearly dropped his coffee and pastry. He set them down, snatched up the paper, and commenced reading. He unconsciously started to walk out of the store as he did so. The woman called after him.
Hey, you need to pay for this.
She indicated the coffee and pastry.
And the paper.
Decker stuck a hand into his pocket, pulled out a five and dropped it on the counter, and walked out, leaving the coffee and pastry behind. The woman and the two men stared after him. He stumbled across the street and perched on the edge of a trash can under a flickering streetlight. The story was long, detailed, and had a picture. My picture, my story. No, not my story. Someone's version of a story that holds far less truth than blatant speculation and lies. He glanced at the byline, though he needn't have bothered. He already knew who it was. Alexandra Jameson. He caught a bus to the Residence Inn, hustled to his room, sat on the bed, and read the story three more times. It didn't change, of course, but it beat into his head with a little more force each time, like a knife repeatedly stabbing flesh. He fell back on the bed and finally slept for a bit. When he woke, it was nearly 9 in the morning. He went to the bathroom, splashed water on his face, went down to the buffet, stuffed his plate with food, poured out 3 cups of black coffee, carried it all to his table, and then sat there, staring down at it. The sun was well up now, and light flooded through the front plate glass windows. The illumination seemed to broadcast him in stark relief, like he was an actor performing on stage under the withering heat blast of a spotlight. He waited, staring at the food. Then his gaze drifted to the newspaper he had set beside his plate. His phone buzzed. He looked at it, hit the answer button. Lancaster said,
"Shit. Amos, what the hell did you do?"
"Nothing. Apparently that's the problem."
"Anybody reading this story will come away thinking you hired Sebastian Leopold to kill your family."
"That's what I thought, even though I know better."
"Why is she after you?"
"Because I wouldn't talk to her."
"So you left her no option but to make shit up?"
"I did meet with Leopold."
"You mean in his cell?"
"Afterward."
"What?"
"I followed him after he was released. It's the picture that's in the article. We were at a bar."
"Why in the hell did you follow him?"
"Because I wanted to talk to him. I wanted to understand why he had told the cops and me that he had murdered my family when he couldn't possibly have."
"And did he tell you?"
"No, he disappeared."
"You mean you lost him?"
"I mean he got in a car and disappeared."
"You saw this?"
"No, but it's the only possibility." He heard her let out a long sigh. He had often heard Lancaster let out long sighs, usually after Decker had done something totally off the wall, even if it had eventually led to the truth in a case they were investigating.
"Amos, I really don't get you sometimes."
He had heard this so many times, he knew that she did not expect an answer, and thus he didn't bother giving one.
"So Leopold is gone?"
"For now," he said.
"People are going to eat you alive over this article. And the witch even included the fact of where you're currently living."
"I have an ace in the hole."
"What's that?"
"I don't give a shit."
Amos, I don't think you understand.
I have to go. He hung up on her and put his phone on the table next to the uneaten mound of food. As he stared down at the pile of eggs, sausages, bacon, and roasted potatoes, he saw not food, but the photo of him and Leopold and the bar. He knew it must seem odd to folks that he would be sitting and drinking a beer with the man who had confessed and then recanted to killing his family. But if he was going to solve those murders, he had to go down any path that presented itself, and Leopold was one such path. He sighed, pushed his plate away, and looked up. June was standing off to the side holding a pan of muffins. She wasn't looking at Decker. She was looking toward the doorway. Decker followed her gaze and saw her. Alex Jameson stood at the door to the breakfast area. She had on black slacks and a frayed black overcoat, out of which peaked a turquoise turtleneck. Her hair was pulled back in a ponytail, and she had on heels that kicked her height up several inches. She walked over to his table and looked down at the paper next to his plate.
"I guess you've read it?"
she said quietly. Decker said nothing. He picked up his fork, pulled his plate toward him, and started to eat. She stood awkwardly next to his table. When he didn't say anything, she said,
"I gave you an opportunity to talk to me."
Decker kept eating. She sat down across from him.
"It's not like I wanted to do this."
He put his fork down, used the paper napkin to wipe his mouth, and looked at her. "I find that people almost always do exactly what they want to do." She tapped the paper.
"You still have a chance to make it right."
"People who make things right do so because they've done something wrong. I've done nothing wrong."
"You were meeting with a man who allegedly killed your family."
"Allegedly. And now all charges are dropped. Which you knew before you wrote this story. And which I knew before I met him in the bar."
"Why did you meet with him?"
"I had questions for him."
"What sorts?"
She took out her recorder, pad, and pen, but Decker held up his hand. "Don't bother." She sat back.
"Don't you want your story to get out?"
Decker shoved the plate of food away, leaned across the table, and said, "I don't have a story to tell." He sat back, pulled the plate toward him again, and resumed eating.
"Okay, fair enough. But do you think Leopold had a hand in the murders, even if he didn't commit them personally? And then there's the fact that the same gun was used at the high school."
Decker eyed her grimly. "Brimmer could get fired for that one. It's not public knowledge. And you know it's not. Or else you would have already written about it. I could call her out on that. You want to see your contact lose her career? Or is that just considered fair game for this story?"
"You're a very unusual man."
"I have no context with which to frame a reply to that observation."
"Sort of proves my point, doesn't it?"
Now Decker sat back and looked at her. "Tell me about yourself," he said abruptly.
"What? Why?"
"I can find out easily enough. Everyone's life is online. So to borrow your phrase, I'm giving you the opportunity to tell your story."
"Is this where I'm supposed to say touché?"
"You have something to hide?"
"Do you?"
"No, but you know all about me." He tapped the paper next to his plate. "Proof is right there. So tell me about yourself."
"What do you want to know?"
"Hometown, family, education, career, life goals."
"Wow, you don't ask for much."
Decker waited. He had no problem with silence, with waiting. His patience, like his mind, had no bounds. She folded her arms across her chest and said,
"I'm from Indiana, Bloomington. I went to Purdue, graduated with a degree in mass comm. Started out at some small papers in the Midwest, basically fetching coffee, writing the crap stories no one else wanted to write, and pulling the shifts no one wanted to pull. I tried some online journalism and blogging, but hated it."
"Why?"
"I like to talk to people face-to-face, not through a machine. That's not real journalism. It's data management fed to you by schmucks you don't even know. It's reporting for lazy people who live in their PJs. Not what I wanted. I want a Pulitzer. In fact, I want a shelf of them."
"Then you came here." Why? Burlington is not a rip-roaring metropolis.
It's bigger than any other town I was in before. It's got crime, interesting politics, cost of living is low, which is important, because when you add up my hours worked, I don't even make minimum wage. And they let me work my own beat and follow up my own stories.
Family?
Large, all back in Bloomington.
And the other reason you came here?
There is no other reason.
He pointed to a finger on her left hand. There were two rings there. The marks are slight but distinct. Engagement and wedding rings. No longer there.
So I'm divorced. Big whoop. So are half the people in this country.
Fresh start, away from your ex? She rubbed at the spot on her hand.
Something like that. Okay, are we done with me?
Do you want to be done?
You understand that you're not actually playing me, right? I'm just feeling generous, sort of going along for the ride, seeing where we end up.
You follow up your own stories, you say?
I do.
Do you intend to try to trace a connection between the killings of my family and the shootings at Mansfield?
Of course.
What do your friends call you?
You're assuming I have friends?
What does Brimma call you?
Alex.
Okay, Alexandra. Let me be as clear about this as I possibly can be. She did an eye roll and looked at him disdainfully.
Do I sense a patronizing lecture coming?
Would you like a scoop? Her expression changed. She picked up her recorder.
Is this on the record?
So long as your source is anonymous.
You have my word.
Do you normally give it that quickly?
You have my word.
An FBI agent was killed last night and her body was left hanging just above our heads on the catwalk up there. She was a skilled, armed federal agent who really can take care of herself. Now she's a murder victim who was dispatched as easily as someone crushing a bug underfoot. He slid the plate out of the way again, reached over, and clicked off her recorder. She made no move to stop him. I've seen a lot in my 20 years on the force, but I have never seen... He stopped, grappling for the right words. I have never seen menace like this. But it's not just that. It's... Again, he stopped, tapping his fingers on the table and closing his eyes. When he opened them, he said...
Men is coupled with brains and cunning. It's a very dangerous combination, Alexander, and I asked about your family only because I wanted to know if you would have anyone to mourn you when you're murdered, too, because please make no mistake. He will kill you as easily as exhaling smoke from a cigarette.
Look, if you're trying to...
Decker didn't let her finish. He could be watching us right now, for all I know, and sizing up where and how exactly he plans to take your life. It seems that he likes to screw with me that way. Kill people I'm close to or associated with. You wrote a big story on me that ties you and me together in just the way this guy seems to love. And I have no doubt he plans to keep killing until it gets down to his last planned victim. Jameson no longer looked disdainful. She looked frightened, though trying hard not to show it.
And who would that be?
She tried to say this flippantly, but her voice cracked halfway through. That would be me. Chapter 32. Alexandra scooped up her recorder, pad, and pen and put them back into her bag and rose. She wouldn't look at Decker.
Okay, if it makes you feel better, you have officially scared the shit out of me.
She said. Did you see Leopold leave the bar?
What?
He tapped the newspaper. The bar where this picture was taken. Now she looked at him, her features weary.
I'm not going to answer that.
You just did. Okay, I have one more question for you.
What?
He held up the newspaper. Where did you get this photo of me and Leopold at the bar? There's no attribution for the photographer. I know the profession is a stickler for that. So I'm wondering why there's no name there.
I took it.
No, you didn't.
How do you know that?
I'm pretty observant. And I happen to know you weren't in the bar. Whoever did take the picture was watching Leopold and me. which means he followed us both there, though I was following Leopold, too.
He paused.
I wouldn't be asking if it weren't important. How did you get the photo?
I got it from an anonymous source.
She finally admitted. And did this anonymous source also supply you with elements of the story you wrote?
I really can't get into that.
If you don't know the name of the source, you don't have to worry about protecting his identity. Decker let the paper fall to the table.
Did it come by email? Text? Surely not snail mail. You wouldn't have had time to write the story.
Email.
Can you send me the email trail?
Why is this so important to you?
Because the person who sent you the email is also the person who killed all those people.
You can't possibly know that.
I know it absolutely. And I would assume that the email said that you should write this story because things smelled bad on this. That here I was meeting with the man accused of killing my family. There must be more to it, right? As he had spoken, Jameson's eyes had continued to widen.
Did you send the email to me?
You mean, so I could see a story plastered in the newspapers basically accusing me of conspiring to murder my own family? She bit her lip.
I'm sorry. That was stupid.
She swallowed with difficulty.
Do you really think it was him?
He was there. He was within 10 feet of me, and I never saw him. And I'm just not sure how that's possible.
You said he was cunning.
Decker nodded. He is. He obviously wants to destroy me professionally before he kills me.
Can I ask you a question?
Decker looked up at her. Go ahead.
Who the hell did you piss off so badly that he's doing all this to you?
Decker didn't answer, because he had no answer to give. He wrote down his email address on the back of a napkin and slid it across to her. Jameson pocketed it, turned, and left. Decker continued to sit there. A few moments later, his phone buzzed. He looked at the screen and allowed himself a brief smile. Jameson had just forwarded him the email trail from her anonymous source. Decker knew that the trail would not lead them back to the sender. That was too obvious. But he wanted to study what the man had written. He pushed his plate aside and stared down at the message. The sender's name was Mallard 2000. That meant nothing to him. He read the message. It basically mirrored what Decker had already deduced. The sender wanted Jameson to write a story raising suspicion about Decker and his family's murder. The word choices were simple and direct. In his mind, Decker imagined Sebastian Leopold uttering each of those words out loud, trying to match the cadence of his stilted speech to the components of the message. But it was off, at least in his mind. They didn't seem to match. There were two of them in this together. One person can't be in two places at the same time. Leopold in jail during both sets of murders. So if he is involved, and I believe he is, there's someone else. Yet there is a problem with that theory. One man with such a vendetta against him, okay. But two of them? He forwarded the email to Lancaster and asked her to try to track it down. He doubted she or the FBI could, but they had to try. He had no computer, so he walked to the public library and used one there. He was not very much of a techie, and his ability to track someone from an email address was limited. He soon exhausted his possibilities on that and got up from the computer. He wandered the shelves, arriving at the non-fiction section. Something had occurred to him on the way over, and a library was a perfect place to check out a theory forming in his mind. The Clutter family. He worked his way to the authors whose last name ended in C, not for Clutter, but for the author of their tragic story. He found the book and slipped it out. In Cold Blood by Truman Capote. The story was both simple and complex. Decker had read it years ago and, as with everything else, had every page of the book neatly stored in his mind. A guy in prison gets a tip from another inmate that a farmer named Clutter in rural Kansas
keeps a lot of money in a safe. The guy gets out of prison, hooks up with a former cellmate, and they head to the farmer's home. They break into the house only to find there is no safe and no money. The tip was bullshit. It should have ended there, but unfortunately for the Clutter family, it didn't. The more timid, though unstable, of the two crooks decides that they must kill the family. His partner, who had been the leader of the pack and the one who had gotten the tip, reluctantly goes along. One by one, the family is murdered. The killers are not smart. They are pursued and caught. After their respective trials and lengthy appeals, they are both hanged at the Kansas Death House.
Tragic all around. Both killers had issues in their backgrounds, problems, troubles, bad stuff, but nothing to justify what they had done. Not that anything could. That part of the story did not interest Decker very much at the moment. What did interest him was the possibility of two men from very different backgrounds coming together at just the right moment and forming a partnership that would lead to the slaughter of so many people. He didn't know Leopold. He had never met the man until he sat at that prison cell. So it wasn't Leopold who had the vendetta against him. It had to be the person whom Leopold had hooked up with. But who was he? He put the book back on the shelf and left the library. As he was walking, his phone buzzed again. It was Lancaster.
"Nothing yet on the email,"
she said.
"You really think it was the guy?"
"I do."
"The FBI is checking it out, too."
"Anything on Lafferty yet?"
"That was the real reason I was calling. Can you meet me at the morgue?"
"Yes, why?"
"Just meet me there. You can see for yourself."
Decker took a bus over to the morgue, which was on the outskirts of Burlington, in an area that, like much of the city, had seen better days. He had pondered Lancaster's words on the ride over, but could not make much of them. What did she want him to see for himself? When he arrived at the morgue's front entrance, she was waiting for him. Her expression was tight, edgy, her hand tremor even worse. "What is it?" he asked.
"Come on, Bogart is already back there."
They walked down halls reeking with the smell of antiseptic and death. The dead had their own aroma that invaded one's eyes, nose, and throat. Morgues were not clean places. In fact, they were extraordinarily dirty. No one had to worry about their patrons dying from infections. Lancaster led the way and finally pushed through a pair of swinging doors. Decker followed her in. The space was large and filled with shelves and stainless steel autopsy tables, three of which were occupied by corpses draped with sheets. Water wands hung down from the ceiling, and there were cabinets filled with both bottles of liquids and the instruments necessary to cut up bodies. The whir of a striker saw sounded from another room. Decker had heard that one before. Someone's skull was being opened up. He wondered if it was a victim from Mansfield, about to have his or her brain plucked out for measuring, weighing, and probing. A group of people was clustered around a table in the far back, Bogart among them. He was once more dressed in a suit, the tie and tie clip just so, the collar tab perfectly horizontal, not a hair out of place, the very picture of professionalism. But in the puffy face, reddened eyes, and slump in posture, Decker read a very different man. There were two other agents with him, and a man Decker knew to be the chief medical examiner. They weren't going to put anyone junior on cutting up an FBI agent. Indeed, Decker was surprised the Bureau hadn't flown in its own guy. Bogart looked up when he heard them approach. He nodded briefly, gave Decker a stiff hello with his eyes, and then looked back down at the body under the sheet. Lancaster said to the M.E.,
"What do we know so far?"
As was noted preliminarily, at the crime scene, cause of death, stab wound to the heart. The body was moved after death. Livor mortis showed that. Blood pooled into the interstitial tissues in her back, but she was found hanging from a light fixture. He uncovered one of Lafferty's arms. With difficulty, he lifted it up, because it was still stiff. She started to come out of rigor now.
extremities backward to the jaw and neck, which more or less confirms the TOD preliminary at midnight.
But the ambient temp? Asked Decker.
It was cold.
My colleague on site made allowances for that. And the deceased was injected with a very powerful sedative. We found traces of it. It would have rendered her unconscious and incapable of defending herself.
And there was mutilation of the genitals, said Decker.
The ME nodded.
But when he started to lower the sheet to reveal the area, Decker stopped him.
We've already seen it.
He looked at Lancaster expectantly. She in turn glanced at Bogart and said,
I haven't told him. Thought he should just see it for himself.
Bogart nodded, and then looked at the other two agents, both burly men who looked like they wanted to kill someone, anyone.
Turn her over.
The ME pulled back the sheet, revealing the body of Special Agent Lafferty. Her skin was very pale in front. The ME had, of course, already cut her open. The Y-incision track sutures across her upper torso looked brutal, menacing, like twin zipper tracks cut into human flesh. Her facial skin drooped a bit because it had been sheared off in one large piece and then put back up. Her skull had been sawed open and her brain taken out before the procedure was reversed and everything was put back together. When they turned her over, the paleness was gone. Her skin there was red, almost burnt-looking from where the blood had pooled. Decker was not focused on that. He was looking at what was on her back. He drew closer because the skin discoloration made it hard to see clearly. But then he did see it. Someone had cut something into Lafferty's back.
Someone had carved out words with the blade of a knife using her body as paper. There were two lines of writing, one directly below the other.
When will it end, bro? You tell me. Chapter 33. They all walked outside. Bogart looked at his men and said,
Give us a minute. I'll meet you at the vehicles.
They left. Bogart turned to Lancaster. I'd like a private word with your partner. Lancaster glanced at Decker, who said, I'll see you later, Mary.
You sure?
He's sure, said Bogart sharply.
Lancaster stared at Bogart.
I'm sorry about Agent Lafferty.
Special Agent Lafferty, thanks. She turned and walked off, glancing back over her shoulder once before she rounded a corner and disappeared from sight. The next moment, Bogart had pushed Decker up against the brick wall of the morgue. He wedged his forearm against his throat. Okay, you fat-ass son of a bitch, we're gonna have this out right here and now. Bogart was big, strong, and in far better shape than Decker, and he had a freight train load of hate and frustration fueling his physical side. Still, Decker had him by well over 100 pounds, and had once been a professional football player. After the men struggled for about a minute, each trying to gain the upper hand, Decker bent his knees and pushed off the wall, and that momentum, combined with his bulk, thrust both men forward, although it was really backward for Bogart. At the same time, Decker hooked his left ankle behind the FBI agent's right one, and the men went down. Decker landed right on top of him, with the impact of a wall collapsing.
While lying flat on his back with over 350 pounds wedged on top of him, Bogart still managed to clock Decker in the jaw.
Decker tasted his own blood and felt a tooth loosen. He slammed his elbow into the side of Bogart's head and heard the other man groan with the impact as his skull ricocheted off the pavement.
I will kill you!
Screamed Bogart as he continued to kick and punch while Decker tried to subdue the flailing limbs. Decker rose a few inches off Bogart and then dropped heavily down, driving his massive shoulders right into the man's diaphragm. Then he did it once more. Bogart grunted, gasped, moaned, and then stopped struggling. Decker rose off him, staggered back, bent over, and tried to regain his own breath, his hands on his shaky knees, his gut heaving, his lungs doing the same. When he looked over, Bogart had sat up, and his gun was pointed at Decker's head. In obvious pain, the man slowly rose, keeping his pistol aimed at Decker.
"You've just assaulted a federal agent," gasped Pogart, holding his injured, bleeding head with his free hand.
Decker looked at the gun and then at Bogart.
"I could arrest you," added the federal agent.
Decker straightened and then collapsed against the brick wall for support. Finally getting his breathing under control, he said,
"Didn't you want to tell me something?" Keeping his gun pointed at Decker, Bogart swiped his hair out of his face and smoothed his tie. He moved closer.
"What?"
"You said you wanted to have it out. I didn't think that meant kicking my ass. I think that meant saying something."
Bogart pointed at the door of the morgue.
"He left a message on my agent that was directed at you."
"I know he did."
"Which means you must know this guy. You must have done something to this guy. He calls you bro."
Bogart shouted out this last part. Decker gave one last heaving breath and pushed off the wall, standing on his own.
"I don't know this guy, and I'm not his bro."
"You say you never forget. Well, apparently neither does this guy.
You did something. Maybe you didn't realize what it was, but he's killed. He's killed."
Bogart's voice trailed off, and he lowered his weapon and then stared at the pavement, shaking his head. His expression, one of complete despair.